was after these matters that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He named him.
And then he told him to take your one and only son that you love, Yitzchak,
and go to the Mount of Moriah
and bring him up there to me as an olah, that is a sacrifice to God,
on one of the mountains that I will show you. That was basically
the command that Abraham received. And
of course we know that it says in the Gemara that Abraham got up early in the morning.
Now that always indicates something that he got. What does it indicate? Well, it says a lot about.
Yeah. It indicates the Torah doesn't
waste time on petty details, so what do we have to know what time he got up?
It's not really important to us, but it means that in spite of the fact that not anxiousness,
it was unless you mean in the sense of desire.
Desire to do the mitzvah was so great.
And this is an amazing thing because what he had to do was so anybody would dread
to be in a state of dread. Face a day
like he had to face. Actually, it was a 3-day journey, but this was the reality.
And it says he got up early, too.
Early, getting up early always indicates that one is acting out of love.
That it's something that a person is looking forward to do.
Because when you're in a state of conflict, you try and put it off as long as possible.
And hope it will go away. But in this case,
he got up early in the morning. This tells us something. And
he tried his animal.
He took his two youths with him, and he took the
wood that he would need and so forth. And they go.
As you know the rest of the story, they go ahead, they travel a journey of
3 days, and he's about to carry on everything.
And he has him bound up. That's the term Akeda.
Akeda means to be bound up.
His hands were tied behind his back to his feet.
He was bound up like an animal about to be sacrificed.
And he took the knife and he was about to actually
kill him and sacrifice him to God.
At that moment, the angel appeared.
An angel of God, which is a messenger
of God, appeared to Abraham. And again, it says, Abraham, Abraham. Repeat it twice. It's interesting.
What is the first of the interview?
11. Verse 11.
An angel called out to
him from the heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, again, he named. Rashi says that the purpose of the repetition is it's an expression of love.
And
his name, in that context, is an expression of love.
It meant that God
had expressed his love of
Abraham at that moment, he had reached a very high level
of closeness to God.
And then he said, do not stretch out your hand
to the youth, and don't do anything to him,
for now that I know that you are one that fears God,
and you have not withheld your one and only son from me.
And then
Abraham looks up, and he sees that there was a ram
caught up in the bushes,
and Abraham went and took the ram, and he brought him as a sacrifice in the place of his son. That's basically the essence, the essentials of the story.
Now, I'm not going to go through every verse, you know, there's
a tremendous amount of things that we can learn from this, I think, but I just want to cover the main ideas.
And to do so, let's set up the major problems of the story. What would you say are the major problems
that the story is involved
with? What's the idea of
a trial?
Hashem, Lord, look at me,
and God tested him. What is the point of why is God testing him? I'm not going to spend too much time. That happens to be a very famous
argument between
the Rambam and the Ramban. I believe I will focus more on the Rambam. Ramban says that the purpose of a test,
I'm just going to state his position.
The Rambam does not agree with this.
But the Ramban holds that God actually does test people.
Test them in the sense that what is the purpose of the test? Because God
knows everything about a person.
God does the idea of a test
is relevant to human relations.
You want to know what the other person is thinking, or
whether he can be trusted or not trusted.
But you want to know something, so you set up a test.
Alright?
Sometimes you can find out something from a test. Teacher test the student.
But that's because you're lacking some information.
But the idea is preposterous when it comes to God. God knows.
It says God the judges.
God is Bohan, Koyo Kolev.
God knows our innermost thoughts.
So what does God have to test?
What would God learn from this?
Okay, it's a good question. How do you answer this?
The Ramban says that it's for the benefit of the subject.
We'll
use that term. The one who's being tested.
What's the benefit?
Of course, you could say he's the person who was a tzaddik, and therefore was
one who was going to follow God's command,
or was not a tzaddik. What's the purpose?
Now, he has a very interesting idea in Ramban.
And he says, this is only for a person on a high level. So, these types, of course, nobody would want to be tested this way. No one would want to be subjected to this type of experience, to be faced with this kind of a challenge. The Ramban says this is for people on a very high level, that are under God's hashkacha, under God's providence. And it is intended to, they have a certain potential.
A person has a certain potential to reach a certain level.
But often in life, we don't reach the level that we could reach on our own.
Each person should be striving for perfection.
And each person
should be trying to maximize its potential.
But very often, you see in your own experiences, it's only because you were subjected to a certain situation, to a certain challenge, and you had to do something. I'm sure you could all think of things like that in your life.
Maybe they were unpleasant.
Maybe you were in a situation where somebody needed help.
There was a
person could have been physically ill or a heart attack or whatever.
And you were the only one around that could help them. And you didn't know what to do.
But you rose to the occasion. And you called
the hospital and you called it.
And you did things. And you said afterwards, in retrospect, you now discovered new things about yourself that you never knew before. So at the time that it happened, you wished it wouldn't have happened.
You know, your reaction was, why me? I can't handle this kind of thing.
Or a person, you know, you read stories in the paper like very often the police can deliver the baby. You know, he had no choice. It was the furthest thing from his mind, but
he rose to the occasion.
So, therefore, certain situations can bring out certain potentials in an individual.
Of course, we can't go around doing these things, setting up tests for people, because we don't have the right.
Only God can do a thing like that. But what he's saying is that when a person is on a very high level and has the potential to reach a new level in terms of his closeness to God, God will set up a test. It's not so that God will discover something, it's to give the person the opportunity to utilize the situation to raise up the high level. That's the position of the Ramban. The Rambam, however, disagrees. And he says that that's not the purpose of the test. But rather, the purpose of the test is, as Davida has said, it is to teach people. It is to teach others. So that nations will know the benefits of following, you know, in the ways of God, and that other people will learn from the example of a truly righteous person. So that this was not for the benefit of Avraham, because Avraham was on this level. He argues, he doesn't like that solution. If a person is on the level of perfection, he doesn't need this experience. Avraham is on the level. But this is to establish an example so that all people will learn a lesson and will know the benefits of living one's life completely in line with faith in God. So this was to demonstrate a lesson for others. Now, let's take our cue from the Rambam. Let me see. The sole object of all the trials mentioned in Scripture is to teach man what he ought to do or believe, so that the event which forms the actual trial is not the end desired. It is but an example for our instruction and guidance. That's basically now, if that's the case, let us apply this to the case of Avraham. What was the purpose of this particular trial? In other words, specifically then, when God commanded him to take his only child and to sacrifice, be prepared to sacrifice his child, what was the point of it? What exactly was being demonstrated over here? What was being demonstrated in the case of Avraham? Okay, so, right, in terms of his... Okay, well, it says specifically his fear of God. I quoted that passage. It says, Now I know, for now I know that you are one of the fear of God. Now my question is, how does this demonstrate the fear of God? Where do we see specifically the fear of God in operation over here? In fact, there's no mention that God threatens him and that he would face any consequences if he failed to do what God commanded. In other words, if you read the story, on the surface, it does not seem that fear is playing a major role. As a matter of fact, in issuing the command to Abraham in Pasuk Bey, verse 2, God says, Kach Noah as Simcha. Please, please say. So that God is addressing him in a language of beseeching him, asking him to please do it. That's certainly not an expression of intended to elicit fear in the individual. So my first question, I'm just going to list the questions, as is my style. I like to set up all the questions first. This is the answer of Hasidim, of quiet people. It's an expression of it's an expression of humbleness and an expression of readiness. In other words, where is it expressed, here I am, expressing I'm ready, which means I'm not your servant. What about the humbleness? Why is it expressed as humbleness? Once you strive for these two qualities, as the terms are inva, which is humbleness, anav, one should be humble, and zimun. Zimun means it's ready, as opposed to the average person is usually in a state of laziness, not ready to... They're only in a state... Well, people are in a state of zimun. I don't believe in laziness per se. They call people lazy. I think that laziness is relative. The most lazy person will really have tremendous energy when it's for something that he wants to do. It just means it's just a general thing that he's available to do things that he wants to do. Except like his immediate gratification. You call lazy. But it's pretty relative. Because when a person's got his energy in something, all of a sudden they're jumping and running and moving, right? When there's something motivating them. It just means lacking in motivation, is a better term. The language that we use doesn't really, not accurate. So what does it mean over here? Where's the humbleness in the term? Here I am. Here I am is not so humble. And here I am. I'm ready. Ready to move. Go. In other words, the term hiyeni means I'm at your disposal. That means that there's a total elimination of all my reservations. For example, when you ask a person for a favor, so you know there's different reactions. I have something important to ask you. It's a big thing. Well, okay, you can tell that reservation. There's a desire to be helpful, but there's a reservation. I have to hear what it is. Let me hear what it is first. But when a person says whatever it is, whatever you want, that means that's the inva. That means that I put aside my own agenda. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm at your disposal. Now, of course, we can't adopt the scenario with regard to our... I'm not suggesting that that would be absurd to do this with regard to fellow man. The fellow man wants you to be willing to help provide you. You want to hear what he is for. But with regard to God, whatever you say, I'm ready. Name. Okay, good. There is the rabbi's comment. I'll cite the, brought down by Rashi. Well, Rashi didn't make it up. Rashi quoted it. Yeah, but it's from the Gemara Sanhedrin. Because it says after these words, Dvarim literally means words. It means after these things. It says that the Satan is a, in English I guess you would translate it Satan. Like, what does that mean? We don't believe in Satan. I hope everybody has heard that. We don't believe. Satan is usually and a symbol of the evil inclination in man. Man's instinctual nature. It was complaining and saying, I'm going to make a bunch of parties in honor of his son, Yitzchak. And it said, from all of the parties that you made, Avram didn't bring any sacrifices to God. So then God answered and said, he didn't do anything, he did everything only for the sake of the son. If I were to say to him, if you slaughter him before me, he wouldn't hold back. Now that's a little bit complex. what the idea behind that is. Let's hold off on that. I would say like this. The major questions that I want to address, is what was the specific nature of the trial? What exactly was being tested? What quality within Abraham was being tested? Was God looking to see if he would give up his son or not? Now I have another question. I have a few questions. Now the Rambam said that this is to demonstrate something. We are all supposed to learn from this. I don't know if you'll accept this as a question, but it seems to me that it's a question. And that is that what Abraham seems to do over here is something which I guess everybody would consider like a superhuman driver. And how many people could face such a thing? Take their child, any child. But this is a child which is born under such a legal circumstance. He had wanted a child for many, many years, and this is a child that was born under miraculous circumstances when he was 100 years old. And to be able to take one's child and travel a distance of 3 days, and in a state of lucidity to go ahead and take a knife and deploy the child, it's almost unbelievable. If Abraham could do it, that's fine. What are we supposed to learn from this? What are we supposed to learn from this? So the Rambam said the whole purpose was, according to the Rambam, was to demonstrate some principle. There's no sacrifice, but it has to be relevant to me. I mean, give me the Torah, like the rabbis say that the Torah was not given for the Malachi Asharis, for the ministers. The Torah was not given for the ministers. It was given for man to live by. It's something that we have to live by. It should be something that's relevant for us. Now, to take an example, the Lo Bashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. It wasn't made for angels, it was made for mankind. So therefore, our ways of pleasantness, and all the paths are peace. It's something that has to relate to me. What am I supposed to learn from this? This is the lesson. It's not going to, and also we see that God told us the lesson not to do it. So no, God is not going to ever ask us to kill our own sacrifice. It's something that God doesn't want. It's something that God clearly does not want man to do. For what? So that I should know now that I should be prepared that if God were ever to ask me to give up my child, I should be in a level like from. Practically speaking, what do I walk away with from this story over here? That's not my question. But that is true, that we do know that God does not want that. But that wasn't the purpose of the story. No, the purpose is Nisa. The trial of Abraham, the fact that Abraham was willing, went so far, would have done it. The action was done. Let's put it this way. The action was done. He did everything that he had to do. The action was done. But miraculously, God stopped it from taking its effect. My next question is, as you know, when do we read the story? Aside from, of course, we read it in the ordinary cycle of Parshas Vayera, but we read it at a special time. We read it on Rosh Hashanah. This story is read on the first or second day of Rosh Hashanah. Anybody? Mi Yodat. The answer is we're doing it on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So therefore what I have to do is a theme of Rosh Hashanah. I want to see if we can... Okay, that's a good point. But, significant, if we can elucidate that as well. What relationship does that have to Rosh Hashanah? And... then, the last question, this is not my own question, many people have noticed it. There seems to be, I may even raise it for discussion with you before, you probably heard this, so I'll do it anyway. There seems to be a complete difference between Abraham's reaction in this case and in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, if you're familiar with the story, when God revealed to Abraham that he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins and their wickedness and so forth, and how does Abraham react? He protests and he debates. I'm not going to go through the whole thing right now, but if you'll read it, you'll see at the beginning of the Sedra, of Vayera, Avram pleads with God and he negotiates with God. If there are 50 righteous people, will you destroy the entire city? And he pleads with God. He negotiates God with God, actually. It's a very fascinating story in the Talmud. Perhaps we'll take it up sometime. And God keeps agreeing with him that if there are 50, then he goes down to 40 and to 30. And you see, he makes all kinds of statements. Will you destroy the righteous together with the wicked? And for heaven forbid that you should do such a thing, to destroy the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be like the wicked. For heaven forbid, shall the judge of all the land not enact justice? And ultimately, God agrees that if there are 10 righteous people, he will not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But as we know, Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. So there weren't 10 righteous people. But what a difference. This has been asked many times. In the case of strangers, when it came to strangers, Avram was involved with the question of God. What is the justice of God? And when it came to his own son, he was without sin, who was innocent, and he seemed to be totally incomprehensible that he hadn't done anything wrong, Avram simply accepted passively, submits to it, that the question is, why is it then that in this case he completely accepted it and not questioned? So, that's my last question. What's that? There's more questions. There's a good question. Look at the question. Let's start off with this question. Why are you saying Sodom and Gomorrah there Abraham is a question. But in the nature of his own son, he was completely accurate. So this is another question. In other words, in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, God, what did God tell Avram? God said that he's pronouncing a judgment against them. That it's the case of Mishpat, it's the case of justice, it's judgment. God was judging them for their wickedness. So therefore, it was within the framework of justice. Now, Avram knew that God is a being of perfection, and everything that God does is perfect. And that God relates to the world through a system of justice. Now, the system of justice is something which is intelligible to human reason, which makes sense to man's mind. We can understand. We have to know the principles of justice because we have to enact justice. So, therefore, why did God reveal what he was going to do? For that very reason, because he wanted Avram to question. It was a learning experience. But when Avram questioned God, it wasn't in the sense that maybe God's making a mistake yet. That would have been the height of arrogance. But rather, in fact, he himself says, behold, I've spoken to God, and I'm but dust and ashes. He himself is recognizing how amazing it is that he can address God. But nevertheless, he has a right to address God. And the only reason he could do so is because God, that's why he says, HaShofet Kala'ara, the judge of all land, Lo Yasa Mishpat. So Mishpat, would you kill the righteous together? These are all principles of Mishpat. So when it came to justice, Avram had a right to question. But when God told him that he was going to kill Yitzchak, did God tell him that Yitzchak is being killed because of a sin? There's no judgment whatsoever. So therefore, it's not in the framework of justice anymore, but it's in a completely different framework. What's the framework over here? It's my will. It's the will of God. And it's in that framework. God did not explain to him why. He didn't give him any framework. It's not in any framework that you can possibly relate to or even understand. It is simply my will. And therefore, Avram did not argue. There's nothing to argue about. What is there to argue? Nor is there anything even to inquire about, nor is there anything even to question. You can't question it because it's part of God's will. And just like it's impossible for us to understand God's nature, because God's nature is infinitely beyond anything that we can understand, so too it's impossible for us to understand God's will. So that's why it's a question. Now the question I want to deal with is, that's an answer to that. Now my question is like this. If that is the case, what is the concept of fear as it is used in this situation? Because it is intended over here to be a test of the fear of God. And as I pointed out before, we don't see where the element of fear comes into the picture. As we see, God did not threaten him. God didn't tell him what dire consequences would occur to him. God said, please say. God is beseeching him to do it. And God uses all these expressions to make it even more difficult to do it. And Rashi says that he was rewarded for each and every expression. Mitzvah, I understand more clearly. What is that? Is a mitzvah, by the way. It's a positive commandment. That's Hashem lo techatzir. The Lord your God shall be fear. So what does it mean when we are commanded to have fear of God? Now, the Rambam gives two different explanations. In the Sefer HaMitzvot, he says, the mitzvah fear of God is that we should live in a state where we are afraid, or we take into consideration the consequences that God does govern the world. It means we are cognizant of the fact that we don't live in a state where we feel we can do whatever we please and there are no consequences, that there is no God in the world. By the way, we discussed that, if you remember, a couple of years ago when we said that the one who takes advantage, who oppresses the widow, the orphan, all people who have no protectors, all people who are basically weak. So we think there's a special covenant that God promises that he will execute swift justice against them. Because these are people who deny God. Because they say there's nothing but physical might. So the Rambam says that in the Sefer HaMitzvot, that the mitzvah to fear God is to believe that there is a God in the world. And he punishes the wicked and preserves the righteous, even though we don't understand the specifics of how it operates. Now that concept of fear of God wouldn't be applicable over here. Because Avram was not motivated to act because of any fear of any consequences. Right? But you're saying that there's another concept. Ah, so where do you get that idea from? Where do you get that idea from? Well, that idea... See, the different interpretation of the mitzvah in the Mishnah Torah. And this is the fear of God which he relates to one of the mitzvahs. What's the other mitzvah related to? It's intimately connected with the love of God, with the mitzvah of love of God. And he says like this, he says, what is the method by which a person comes to love God and to fear God? The two are connected. So he says that when a person thinks and understands, he gains a certain understanding of God's actions and God's wondrous creation. In other words, he studies the world of nature, science, and he recognizes the greatness of the wisdom that's reflected in the world of nature. He sees God's wisdom, which has no measure and no end. Immediately he loves and praises and extols. And he has a desire, he experiences a tremendous desire to know this great being. In other words, when a person gets a sense from the study of science, actually, so you see that there's no conflict, as far as the Torah is concerned, between a true belief in God and a genuine involvement in the study of science. The study of science, if done properly, is something which is a mitzvah. It's part of the mitzvah of love of God. And anybody who studies the world of nature correctly, intelligently, must come to a recognition of God and the love of God. And this is, I know I have a quote before me right now, but the Einstein writes about this. Einstein's words, when he expresses the feeling that he has, and when he gains an awareness of the tremendous wisdom in the world, he believes in God, by the way, Einstein. He didn't believe in Torah. He didn't have a teacher to teach him about the reasons why the Torah is true. So he just respected Judaism. But he had no way of knowing that it's a divine system, but he believed in God. And he was a very religious person in the sense he had this feeling of awe and love. He was filled with fascination. Love of God is really fascination with the Creator. Not with the creation, but with the being. He gets a sense of the spirit. He calls it the spirit behind the creation. And he has to explore. He wants to get further and closer. He always, to the source. He always used expressions like, God doesn't play dice with the universe. Everything he believes has an explanation. And every interesting point I like to make is a very interesting point. I think it's worthwhile to think about. But today, in today's world, many so-called scientists I didn't want to see Asia. They're very, very proud. You know, they're very proud to come out. They know that, you know, very, very frequently, today scientists. Although, historically, most of the great philosophers and scientists all believe in that. But today's society, many of the mythologists, the physicists, and so forth, they're just pointing out that it's really absurd that every scientist is really a believer. If you think about it, in order to be a scientist, you must be a believer. Can anybody hear me why? Otherwise, like this. You say, for example, I'm sorry? Now, for example, do you ever, you pick up some of these, you know, a lot of books today, or poetry, a lot of the contemporary stuff, which, you know, people are trying to sound like poets, but a lot of it is like modern art. You look at it and you can't figure out what the heck it is. It looks like something that's flat or something. Well, you read some of the fiction or you read some of the poetry, and it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It sounds like crazy rambling. Now, sometimes you pick up a book, and you read it, and it doesn't make much sense. So what do? You're trying to figure it out. Maybe he's saying something. Right? Now, it depends who it is. I mean, if you find out that the person who wrote it is basically nuts, or he's unstable, or he's crazy, I mean, you're not going to waste... Why waste your time? There's contradictions every other page you contradict yourself. You're not going to spend time trying to unravel and you'll see. No, there's really no contradiction, but you really see that beneath it there's really tremendous depth and consistency. Now, however, if I were to tell you that this was written by a great thinker and he thought everything through carefully and he was a master logician, and that's in fact like when we spread the Torah in the Rambam, you see a contradiction. We say, no, it can't be, because the Rambam was aware of this. And if you think about it and you study it, you'll see that behind the apparent contradiction, there's really consistency. Alright? So you have to have a certain, let's use the word faith, that the person who I'm studying is really a person of great depth. And if I don't understand something, I should really make an effort. Now, if a person does not believe that the world is the result of a infinite being, so why study? Why do scientists consider when you're like, and they spend their entire lives? Why do they do so? Because they believe that at bottom everything has to make sense in the universe. If the universe is perfect, that it all makes sense, that it's logical, and if they just keep searching, they'll find an answer. But why do they believe that? Well, on what basis? It's all chaos. You see what I'm saying? Implicitly, you're saying that there's a tremendous order in the universe. Then where does that come from? How do you know? Oh, well, if you believe that the universe is the product of an infinite being of perfection, so of course this universe must express that perfection. Everything makes sense. But if you don't believe that, so you're crazy. That's a tremendous amount of faith. In other words, every scientist is a man of faith. He's got faith that there's an order to the universe. And where is that faith based on? You see what I'm saying? So the person who claims now, they're assuming that everything has to have a reason. They're assuming that everything in the universe must have nothing
to
be.
There's reasons for looking for a reason.
But that'll only make sense.
That there isn't a God.
But the point is, you'll find in every area, not just in evolution, oh man, but in every area of physics, in everything in the universe that you study, let's forget about, you just took what evolution for the time being. There too, they have to account for everything. They will study nature, and the underlying premise is a certain faith that there is an answer that makes sense. Now why? If the universe is a result of chaos, so why it won't make sense? It should be contradictory. Why study it? You see what I'm saying? The point is that the very study of the universe is an act of faith. The faith being that it's all systematic, that it's all orderly. It is an act of faith. It may not be, but there is an act of faith. They're operating on faith. Because if you don't assume that everything has to fit, that there's an answer for everything, then there's no basis for it to study science. It doesn't make sense. Implicitly, that there is order in the universe.
But they don't relate to
okay, that's what I'm saying. I understand that. But the point is, then, the way they get that from. Where does that come from?
Human nature.
Ah, but that's not, they're not being consistent. Because why should you have that faith? They haven't been a faith to them. It is a faith.
Human nature is to search out
knowledge. No. But we're assuming insofar as they're aware of what they're doing. They'll defend what they're doing, not just acting instinctively. But they are men of faith. So why should they, in other words, they like to sneer at faith and act as though they're supreme rationalists. But they're men of faith. The very fact that they study is based upon faith, that there's a system here. That the whole thing is going to work out. There's a system. All right. Now, we say if there is a system, then it has to be the result of some being that put the system together. They may disagree, but that there is a system, they have faith in that, and where do they get that from? Okay. Let me, I don't want to spend too much time on that point right now. Anyway, that's the love of God. And so therefore the love of God is really that desire, that thirst to get closer to the spirit, so to speak, behind the creation. Then it is like this, and when the person begins to consider all these things, he thinks about them, immediately he stops in his place. He stops in his place, and he fears, and he trembles, and he knows that he is a very small creature, dark and lowly. And he stands with a very minute type of understanding, of intellect, in the presence of the perfect, the one who has perfect knowledge, in the presence of God, relative to God. That's what he calls the fear of God. So what the Rambam is saying is a totally different idea over here. Not the fear of consequences, but a sense of awe, which is very intimately connected to the sense of love. Love seems to be the positive expression, the sense of fascination and desire to be with, because that's the expression of love. And the other side of that coin is, he reflects upon himself. It seems to be in two stages. In the first stage, he's completely consumed. He's not even thinking about himself. In other words, these two stages, I believe, they occur consequentially. In the first stage, he gains an awareness of his being beyond the universe. He's fascinated because he's the wisdom. He sees the growth, the wisdom. I don't think he's thinking about himself at this point. But man being the creature that he is, he has to integrate all of his experiences. Whenever a person has an experience, makes the kind of thing, it always, if it's a meaningful experience, in the first place, he's not thinking about himself. I don't know, whatever the experience might be. When you've seen, let's say you met a person or you heard a great speaker or a great thinker, whatever it is, a class, whatever it might be. In the first phase, you didn't think about yourself. You didn't touch the fascination. There's no energy going to yourself. But then afterwards, on the way home, and it now affects your place. Things will never be the same. No matter what happens, from now on, my life will be different. And I don't know how, it depends on what the experience was. And that's what he says over here. The effect upon the self is that he can never, he has to give, what do you think he's giving up over? He's giving something up over here. Because he says, near to Lachora, he's like sort of pulled back. He's pulled back. So he's put in his place here. So what can never be the same? What will never be the same? Exactly. His own sense of himself. Each person naturally has a certain sense of himself. Each person. Now, so whatever that sense, how active it is, of course it's always natural. And the person in his life is always struggling to get some accuracy with that. And but everybody has a false sense of himself. And it's usually on the overestimation side. Of course, there are people that you'll notice that underestimate themselves. Yes. But that's usually a reaction to overestimating. It's usually, it's very psychologically, it's usually the reaction from their eyes. It's an inferiority complex and so forth. It's a complicated thing. I don't want to go into all the psychology. It's not necessary right now. But the point of it is, though, this is true humility. A person can never feel the same way about himself when he's experienced what the Rambam is talking about. Because, and that's why he says about who was the humblest of all people? Moshe. Moses was the humblest of all people. And who was the greatest of all people in terms of understanding of God? And who was the closest to God? Was Moses. Was Moshe. So therefore, the greater one's understanding of reality, the more humble he has to be. Because he recognizes his true place. So that, and as far as beauty is concerned, every type of arrogance and egotism is really a result of ignorance. And the less a person knows, the more out of line with reality is human culture. Now, before I apply this concept to the case of the Akedah, I just wanted to read to you what the Rambam says. The Rambam explains the test. He says like this, on page 306 of the Guide. The account of Abraham, our father, binding his son, includes two great ideas or principles of aspects. First, it shows us the extent and limit of the fear of God. Abraham is commanded to perform a certain act, which is not equaled by any surrender of property or by any sacrifice of life, for it surpasses everything that can be done, and belongs to the class of actions which are believed to be contrary to human feeling. This is what I said before. He's being asked to do something that is contrary to human feeling. He has been without child and has been longing for a child. He had great riches and was expecting that a nation should spring from his seed. After all hope of a son had already been given up, a son was born unto him. How great must have been his delight in the child. How intensely must he have loved him. And yet, because he feared God and loved to do what God commanded, he thought little of that beloved child and set aside all his hopes concerning him and consented to kill him after a journey of 3 days. If the act by which he showed his readiness to kill his son, I said, well, now he's explaining why God set it up that it should be a distance of 3 days journey. Why didn't he tell him to do it immediately? If the act by which he showed his readiness to kill his son had taken place immediately when he received the commandment, it might have been the result of confusion, emotion, and not of consideration. But the fact that he performed it 3 days after he had received the commandment proves the presence of thought, proper consideration, and careful examination of what is due to the divine command and what is in accordance with the love and fear of God. So the Rambam over here emphasizes, it seems to me, more the fact that he was called upon to give up something that he loved very much for the love of God. He doesn't seem to emphasize and explain too much where the fear comes into the picture. Doesn't he seem to emphasize more the love? Because he says, and yet because he feared God and loved to do what God commanded. So the love of God's command was greater than the love that he had for his own son. But the pasuk emphasizes the fear aspect. And I want to see how the two things are together. So I want to say like this, and I'll try and explain the relevance to us. He's giving up. So that's precisely why it's the fear of God. Because since all these things the Rambam has mentioned, the fact that he loved the son, the fact that he was waiting, and why did he have, why was it so important to him? Why were all his emotions tied up with the son? It wasn't just an emotional thing, it was because of the purpose, the promise of God to build a nation. Meaning to say that what God asked him to do went completely, 100%, against everything that made sense to him. It made absolutely no sense whatsoever. And that is precisely where in the text. In other words, he gave up. What did he give up over here? It wasn't the son that he had to give up so much. But he had to give up his own sense of right and wrong. That's the ultimate. In other words, each person operates with a certain innate sense of what's right and what's wrong. And people are going, you'll see this, I mean, everybody has their own, and people haven't studied philosophy. It's a subjective type of thing. You see, every group has its own moral code, and they're completely convinced. And you can't argue with them, no matter what it is. Like all the major issues in today's society, pro-abortion, pro-life, anti-abortion, pro-life, pro-capital punishment, against it. All of these things, the groups are formed, and each group is completely convinced, even though they can't prove their point of view. They just select the arguments that back up their point of view. And the other one selects arguments. Each one has a tremendous conviction. They're ready to kill for these things. And the Yadis believe, Judaism believes, that this innate sense that a person has of right and wrong. You see people like, they mount up even in matters of etiquette, what's right, well, they should have called me back, and a person is supposed to thank you when you do things like this, and it's wrong to not to acknowledge me, and I did. You know, like in day-to-day occurrences, you notice each person has a certain code that they operate by. And if, then you'll point out things, well, but you did this, yeah, but that's different. When I did that, that was a different situation. You think of each person, I mean, you can't follow how it works, because nobody knows how it works, because each person is feeling as to what's right and what's wrong.
Good is really, it's just whim. It's all based upon emotional whim. And that the only way that a person can actually, the only true morality is that which is dictated by God. And that's what God gave us, the Torah. And we really have no way of knowing. Of course, there are certain things we can discover with rationality. But all these issues, for example, that's why without all these questions, for example, there's no way that a person... The major question today, well, let's take the question of abortion, for example. What is the true? What's correct? What is the correct position? Pro choice or pro life? The truth of the matter is that we have to follow the Torah. In terms of human wisdom, human understanding today, you can't answer the question. Because nobody can define when life begins, when human life begins, at what point. Or the question of capital punishment. You can argue, well, I mean, issues like whether it is a deterrent, whether it's not a deterrent. But even if you could prove that it is a deterrent, how do you know that it's legitimate? That it's just take one person's life for the benefit of society. At what point? You don't know. Only God. Only God. It's only because it is the will of God. The will of God is the source of all morality and ethics. So the ultimate awe of God, the ultimate fear of God is when a person recognizes how small he is, which means to say he realizes that his own view, his own sense of the truth of what's right and wrong is completely has to be pushed aside. Of course, you have to do the best you can, but it means he accepts the will of God when it's completely inscrutable, when it makes absolutely no sense to him. That's the ultimate question. It's the realization that how can he question God? That the whole idea of his questioning God is completely absurd, because what he has, his small capacity for understanding is so minimal, is so limited, that there's absolutely no way. No matter what, if God tells him that this is right, no matter how much it goes against his own sense of things, he's got to follow it. That's the ultimate test. That's the idea of being tested over here. Now, it's interesting. What God chose to contest over here, what he had to go against, was not just any emotion. God could have set up the test with regard to, you know, there are many emotions that would have been difficult to overcome. But which particular emotion did God challenge him on? His emotion of compassion, of love and compassion. And why that emotion? In fact, that's what we decide on Rosh Hashanah. That Kavash Rachamav, he conquered his mercy, his compassion, Lasa Sutoncha, to do your will. Because of all the emotions, see, people, you'll notice that whenever a person has a powerful emotion, they believe that he's right. You know, like, you believe it's got to be right. If I feel that, it can't be. It can't be that this is wrong. Feel so good, it has to be. How can anything which is so, which feels so right, how can it be wrong? Impossible. But people, you notice, one second. Now, that was a question of justice, though. You'll notice that when it comes to the emotion of compassion, there, people have a greater sense. Right? Whenever the emotion of compassion is opposed by something, that's why, for example, that's the hardest emotion to conquer. Because then you're even looking as if you're doing the right thing. But, according to Judaism, there is no, for example, Christianity believes that compassion per se is good. That's why they're against wars, or the right preemptive wars, or this whole idea of this whole today's society of punishment.
You can't punish a criminal. You have to forgive him. Right? So you see, and people don't feel any guilty. They don't feel guilty that by forgiving this individual and by not punishing him, so then you're making things worse. So you could be harming people, other people. He goes out and he kills other people. That they don't feel guilty about. If they don't feel guilt, they will feel guilty if they punish the wrong person, accidentally. But they won't feel guilty if they let the wrong person off the hook and he kills somebody else. Why? Because they were following their emotions and directly. It's a very powerful feeling. When a person does a compassion, you'll see, parents also feel this way. Parents, in general, you'll see, when it comes to if they're not sure, they will lean sometimes more towards the side of compassion, of leniency. Now, if they make a mistake with regard to being too harsh on the child, they'll feel guilty about it. If they make a mistake, and that mistake was on the side of leniency, they may say we made a mistake, but they won't feel as guilty about it because they feel good. They were good. They were in line with their feeling of leniency and compassion. They don't feel as guilty about a mistake in leniency as they do about a mistake in harshness. Oh, you're so harsh. You should be guilty. They'll run out and they'll buy him 20 presents to make him feel better. They can't tolerate that because they feel guilty about their own aggression. But they don't feel as guilty if they made a mistake and they spoil the child. All right, we shouldn't do it. We have to be strict the next time. They don't feel guilty about it. Why? Because their emotion of compassion tells them that this is the right thing to do. So, therefore, the test of Avraham was not so much that he could separate from his child as that he could give up his entire sense of right and wrong based upon the most powerful emotion, the emotion of compassion. And that's what we're reading on Rosh Hashanah. And I think that the relevance for Rosh Hashanah is, and the relevance for us, I asked that question before, we're not on that level. How many people could do that? See, I believe it means like this, that in order to be a Jew, in order to accept God, each person has his own akedah. I think that each person has his own personal akedah. And one's own akedah means there's an area in each person's life where his own sense goes against God. He's in conflict with the will of God. And I don't know what it is because each person is different. But each person has certain drives, certain desires, certain personal desires that are very important to his own sense of self, to his own ego. And he can't accept certain things. Well, for many people, like that's the whole basis of his whole thing about the Holocaust. Can't accept it. Can't accept it. Why? Well, God says that this is the way the world has to be, and the Jewish nation has a certain purpose, and we have to function in a certain way, and if certain things are done, things are wrong with us. In fact, all the Holocaust literature today is very much against the basic principles of Torah, because they're not like God, but it reinforces this emotion, it's an horrendous kind of thing that should never have happened, and that certainly if we ran the world, it wouldn't have happened. Denial of God. What do you mean? What do you know? It's basically, I mean, just the underlying message that's coming through. People also, by the way, as when there are tragedies, you know, people have to be careful what they're saying. They're trying to console the person by the idea that somehow it's wrong that this kind of a thing could even happen. That's different. Now the change. All right, yeah. The focus should be. There's nothing of God. That's not the focus of most people. I mean, most of the people that approach the subject. The focus is that it's something that just can't be explained. The focus is something that just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It just can't be explained. And somehow you have to keep your faith. But the underlying idea is that it's wrong. That it's wrong. It shouldn't happen. I wish I could change it. The idea is that there's something wrong with it. Or a tragedy. When they can tell, there's something wrong. Yeah, you're right. Or even when there's a tragedy, people try to control. Discussing with somebody. Because recently with, you know, the death of Kahani. So some people say, well, even people that opposed him all his life, like this person, this guy Foxman, ADL. So he came to the funeral, and it was a funny kind of thing. He did come to the funeral, but then he had to distance himself again from Kahani, because God forbid he said that he approved of him. He says, well, one thing he did was this idea of never again. That was something to give him. So saying, what was so terrific about the idea of never again? Now, that was that there'll never be another Holocaust. Now, Kahani didn't mean it that way, but the way he understands never again It's really a denial. I want to know, and the average secular Jew, you know, has this motto of never again, he's really denying God. Because he means to say that we will now, why did the Holocaust occur? Because we were powerless. We didn't have a state. We didn't have a state. And if there was an Israel, there would never have been a Holocaust. Any person that takes any position like that and says if there was an Israel, or if the Jews would have gotten out, if they had done such and such, that's a total denial, because what we're saying is that the Holocaust could not have occurred unless it was the will of God, and it was a very serious punishment for some very serious sins. So therefore, the state of Israel could not have prevented the Holocaust. There's no way. Now, when you say never again, you're saying it lies within our power. If you mean it lies within our power, in the sense that we will follow the Torah and never be guilty, if you mean it's because we will, that's one thing. Well, first of all, there's no way anybody can really guarantee that, but okay, at least your idea is correct. But that's not, when they say never again, they mean with the fist. They mean that we will never allow it to happen again, which means to say that it's preventable by our actions. That's a denial of power, because it didn't happen because we were powerless. The view of the Torah is that when major events occur to the Jewish people, we could have been without any power whatsoever. The Jews today could have no state. Let's say there was no state and we had no physical power. If we were to adhere to the Torah and follow God's will, God would protect us and no enemy could harm us. Yeah, I understand. No. I'm saying it's true, because we're doing that. We are protecting ourselves. Oh, not because we believe that by doing so we have the power to prevent things, but only because God wants us to act in our own sphere. So we're doing it in the framework. Yeah, I understand that was, but that wasn't the major sin of the Holocaust. No. It's hard to say that was. Well, I'm not going to go into that. I'm not saying that I know what the major sin is. All I'm saying is, though, if you have the attitude that many people have, let's take, it's not only Israelis, it's Americans. Let's take an American who is secular, who believes that if we are strong as a people and we stick together and we have physical courage, that we can prevent another Holocaust, that's against the Torah. Because the underlying cause is not the absence of physical strength. The underlying cause was an onus, a punishment from God. That the ultimate idea over here is that we're talking about is each person has an activity, that's all I'm going to say. That in order to be a Jew, it means in order to really accept God properly, a person has to overcome his own activity. But it's his own personal emotional activity, his own area in which he denies God. And I think that's why we read the story on Rosh Hashanah. Because what's the theme of Rosh Hashanah? Malchus, which means on that day we accept the fact that God is king. Now what do you mean God is king? God is king can't be God is king and I know what's right and wrong. If you cannot accept God as king and retain your own personal sense of right and wrong at the same time, it means that my acceptance of God as king has to be like Abraham. I've got to overcome all my emotions. If there are certain, exactly, even my good emotions, exactly. That's why Shaul was punished. The Jews were punished because they had mercy on the Amalekites. For the emotion of mercy, they were punished. So you're just as culpable. Why? Exactly why? Because you couldn't accept God's, exactly, you couldn't accept God's judgment. Your own idea of right and wrong is expressed. That's what happened, as we learned in the book of Shoftim, when they first entered the land. And God said to wipe them out completely, idolatry from the land. And they couldn't do it. They fought and fought. Based on their emotions of compassion. That's the idea that we can gain from this. It doesn't have to be on this level, but each person. That's the essence of the prayer. What do we pray for? For the same time, we're going to place God. To do your will with a and the true fear of God expresses itself is we do God's will with a complete heart, not with a partial heart. I mean, most people do God's will with a partial heart, what's in line with our own emotions. But here, we're willing to put aside all of our emotions and to bind ourselves up with the will of God. That is the true fear of God. So, that's...